Welcome to episode 28. I'm your co-host, Ryan Turek, and I'm joined by Mr. Rob G.
Hello.
Mr. Elric Kane.
He's last.
All right.
No, make him last.
Dr. Rebecca McKendry.
I want to be last.
And Elric the Last Kane.
The interrupter.
For any of our listeners who are worried that Ryan might be taking over the show, this is your evidence. He just did the intro. That was mind-blowing.
It was well done. It was nicely paced. I got to say, Elric is sitting here in a suit jacket, and it's a little alarming.
His presentation.
I'm always this smooth.
He's been threatening to change this entire time we've been getting stuck.
Midway through the show, the pants are coming off. It's going to get weird.
I like this knuckle duster mug.
I found this in the kitchen. Isn't this cool?
That is the coolest mug I've ever seen.
I'm drinking my green tea from a mug that has like brass knuckles.
And I believe, and this is a great segue, I believe that is our TV exec's mug, Jessica Rhodes.
Oh, did I steal Jessica Rhodes' mug?
I believe so.
I will wash it.
All right.
So Jess,
I love it.
Jess,
evidence on the show now.
So, yeah, and Jess one time took my Frankenstein mug, and I was like, oh, man.
I remember. You blame me for that.
I did blame you for that.
Jerk.
And now it's gone.
As if I wouldn't have my own Frankenstein mug.
I have my
mug.
Suspicions on who took the mug.
I will wash this mug and return it to its place on the shelf.
But speaking of Blumhouse TV, we have a really cool event happening this December in the form of a digital series on YouTube Red called 12 Deadly Days. It kicks off on December 12th, and it features an eclectic array of stories and directors and writers. And with us, we have two of the main creators of the show, Chris Kalari and Jennifer Raitt.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, guys. Hey.
How's it going? So before we kind of like launched into our usual, you know, shenanigans of what we've seen and all that stuff, they had a few moments to talk about the show.
Yeah.
It's a great thing about you literally are kind of experiencing the Blumhouse kind of vibe around the office. It's like, oh, hey, you guys are in the office. Let's just grab you and have you talk about the show.
Talk.
Especially, what is YouTube Red? Let's start there.
Yeah.
And let's just clarify, it is not RedTube.
Okay.
As Elric is.
I was hopeful.
Exactly.
I thought Blumhouse was going edgy. I liked it.
We're not that sexy.
All right. Well, first off, just clarify what YouTube Red is.
So YouTube Red is the pay channel wing of YouTube. They do a lot of original content connected to YouTubers that are popular on the channel. Some of it's reality, some of it's comedy, some of it's they've done a couple movies.
Yep.
And they were looking to do some genre content.
Yeah.
So they wanted to kind of take a swing, and they wanted, I think, to partner up with Blumhouse. And they're in that awesome kind of embryonic phase. Like, it feels a little bit like early days of MTV or Nickelodeon or something, where like the Pete and Pete's are getting made,
right?
because they're still they know certain things that work, but they're still not so boxed into something that they're like, well, we're only going to do this now.
Oh, that's exciting. And I think it's the first time Pete and Pete's been ever been brought on the show.
Maybe.
So just describe your roles on the show for us.
So Chris and I created the show. We also show ran, and we like together wrote 4.5 of the episodes, and we directed one as well. So we were sort of mom and dad.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we came up with the show the Christmas of 2014. We sold our first show.
Right.
With Blumhouse. We sold it in the fall, and we thought that over Christmas we were going to need to be kind of like on call because we were still going to be deep in the notes process. And so we didn't go home that year, and it was the first Christmas that we'd both spent in LA, and we were kind of homesick and watching a lot of Christmas movies and just started talking about the kind of genre Christmas stuff that we like. And over the course of a handful of days, kind of tossed back and forth a whole bunch of really weird Christmas stories that we were like, we've never seen anybody do this. We've never seen anybody do that. And a lot of times, you know, I think the reason we hadn't seen it as a feature was because, like, it's an idea that holds up great for the length of a Tales from the Crypt episode totally, or something. Yeah. But if you tried to do one of these for an hour and a half, it, you know, wouldn't work as a movie. So,
and also the kind of like gestation process to get a feature version of a Christmas tale off the ground is in and of itself like an uphill battle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Can I quickly break in and just say, holy fucking shit, you're doing Christmas horror. I had no idea. I'm two steps behind. Now I'm fucking excited. So let me speak for the audience. I'm on board.
Wait a minute. Elric, have you seen the trailer yet?
No.
Okay,
I haven't
all
seen
right.
anything.
Well, this is where I want to come in then, because obviously.
I don't work at Blumhouse. Come on.
You know, I know Chris and Jen socially in here at the office, and I've talked to them a bit. And obviously, we've seen them for the last several months working on the show, mm-hmm. and there's been other friends. Our friend Josh Miller was in there too. But you never know what they're doing. You're just like, oh, they're working on some show.
They just had Nerf guns in their office that
yes,
we would come
that
in and
we
play
would
with.
Steal. They're like, oh, yeah, they're not serious. They have Nerf guns. It's fine. Yeah. But the great surprise, I mean, I knew it was a Christmas horror anthology thing. There's going to be 12 episodes for YouTube. But seeing the trailer earlier this week, I was kind of blown away.
Yeah.
And I mean this in the best way possible, because obviously it's Christmas and we're as weird horror fans, anytime a holiday comes up, we must watch every horror movie from that
right.
holiday, good or bad. There's not a lot of good Christmas horror movies. Not at all. There's a few. But watching the trailer, I was like, this is just what I needed.
And they're giving it to us on 12 different, you know, episodes.
Yeah.
You know? It's like you get 12 different stories as opposed to one feature-length movie, you know, that we can just rewatch year after year. Now we get, like, an abundance.
Yeah.
We're spoiled.
Yeah. Well, in terms of number of hours, we were talking about it, and we were like, we might have doubled the amount of Christmas horror content
that's right.
that exists in the world. Like,
right,
from,
we essentially right. just added 6 hours of...
Yeah.
Probably
so,
not quite, but yeah.
Really quick, take us through who the filmmakers are. Who did you guys bring on board?
So we got so lucky. We got.
Well, we should start with some of the writers, honestly, because
sure.
Pat
yeah.
and Josh, we brought on right away.
Yep. Pat Casey
and
Josh
Miller. Yeah, because we knew them socially, and we also knew Golan the Insatiable, which was a cartoon that they'd had on Fox a few years ago.
Yep.
Which
and
we have an episode on Killer POV about.
Yeah, with Josh.
In
yeah.
our horror cartoon
right.
episode, we talked about that.
Fucking hilarious.
And now they're
right.
on Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yes. And now they're doing Sonic the Hedgehog.
The movie.
Yes. And so we were like, if this show happens, we have to get.
Well, we had drinks with Josh one night, and this was like sort of maybe happening. And we were like, so how would you feel about maybe coming on the show? And then it was like, well, when will we be starting? We'd be like, oh, well, probably like next week.
Yeah, the show came together very quickly. But we got Pat and Josh on board. And then we reached out to Jackson Stewart, who is who's a friend of ours. And we were like, hey, this show's happening really fast. We'd love to have you write an episode. And we reached out to a couple of other friends.
Which, by the way, I had Jackson's on the show, the next show, and had no idea he had anything to do with your show.
Yeah.
So this is just coincidental booking. But good booking.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, yeah, we reached out to a bunch of strong genre writers first off the bat. And then when it came to who was going to direct the episodes, Jen and I, from the minute we found out the show was going to happen, we were like, we have to get Joe Lynch somehow to direct this pilot, because we didn't know Joe, but I was a fan of his and we knew his work. And I listened to Movie Crypt and stuff. So I knew Christmas horror was like kind of his thing. But he hadn't done episodic TV. So, and there's a bit of a difference in worlds between feature film directors and TV directors, because in TV, the writers are usually a little bit more in charge. Mm-hmm. And it's a different pace and everything. But we were like, guys, you have to get Joe to do this. And everybody checked out his work and was very cool about it and was like, yeah, sure. So we got Joe on. And then... Who came next?
Joe directed the first two episodes, and then Joe Menendez directed 3 and 4. He's directed a lot of television. Mm-hmm. He worked on the From Dusk Till Dawn, the series, and he
and
just
12
did
Monkeys.
The 12 Monkeys. Yeah. He just did the Legends of the Hidden Temple movie, which was like something on set I found out about, and like 12-year-old Jen exploded.
Is that the Nickelodeon show?
Yeah.
Oh man, I used to love that show.
Yes.
Joe is amazing, and I'm just doing it in order of episodes. Then Josh Miller directed.
Oh, cool!
Right. Then we directed Troy Miller, another Miller, who is our EP from the production side, mm-hmm. directed an episode, and he's directed like on every comedy project ever.
Yeah, his the Flight of the Conchords was his show. And so anyway, then John Hyams came on board because we needed somebody who could pull off a really stylish episode in a very incredibly short amount of time. And he was one of the first people that came to mind, and just through a couple of asking a couple of people, were able to get in touch with him, and he came in and knocked it out of the park. And then Pat directed an episode.
And the thing that maybe blew our mind the most was we have one of the episodes is a found footage episode, and we kept telling Blumhouse, we were like, guys, you're Blumhouse, like, you have to help us get a found footage director to direct our found footage episode. And we were going back and forth on some people with availabilities, and one day Raghav, one of our Blumhouse execs, came to us and was like, why don't you guys think about having Ed Sanchez direct?
And we were like pull over the car kind of a moment of like, are you kidding? Nice. Yes, absolutely. So Ed was a dream, and we actually...
Well, and it was Ed and his directing partner,
Greg Hale, because in the features side of things, we were developing a film with those two. And because the film wasn't quite ready, we were able to just tee it up.
Yeah.
It's like, Ed, Greg, keep developing this thing, and then like have fun with TV. And they were like, yeah, this is great.
Yeah, they were so cool. And one of the most exciting things that happened on the show was also in their episode. Jen is a huge fan of Josh Leonard, the actor, who had been in Blair Witch Project.
And separately, like for another episode, we'd been trying to get him to play the lead, and he was really into it. Casting was super excited about it, and our dates kept changing because of like various production issues, and like last minute, like Josh couldn't do the dates for the episode we wanted him for, and I was devastated. And then Rich Mento, our amazing casting director, was like, well, there's this mom character in this episode. We had like a single mom, and he was like, Could she maybe be a single dad?
And we were like, put Josh in Ed's episode? Sure. Yes, we'll do that.
Cool.
And so sure enough, the it all came together, and we were able to have a little Blair Witch reunion on set, which was just like the cool. There was a moment where Ed needed Josh to, like, holding the camera, kind of look down into a box to see this gross thing. And Josh was like, I don't know. It just feels a little weird. I'm not sure why I'd be like looking from this angle or getting this close, blah, blah, blah. And Ed was like, it's like that moment in Blair Witch, you know, with the sticks. And Josh just deadpans, yeah, I've never seen that movie. And I was like, I can die happy. That's wonderful.
That's amazing.
Now, what about, can you talk a little bit about the tone of the overall show? Because before you mentioned Tales from the Crypt, and I feel like we should tease the audience a little bit about some of the stuff.
Don't go too. I wouldn't go too, but I would into detail and story wise. But I would just say go see the trailer. It's on YouTube, and like give us, as Rob's like kind of alluded to, is like give us the tone, like the vibe. Like, what kind of is it? Fun horror, over the top horror, gory horror.
I mean, all of our references going back to the pitch, but I think it remained very true to that. It was Gremlins and Shane Black and The Nightmare Before Christmas, and it's very much in a fun space.
Yeah, I've been comparing it to like when I listen to like a weird Christmas song mix, and a lot of times you get like, you know, you'll get like a punk rock band doing different Christmas songs or whatever. But I usually draw the line at when like a death metal band tries to do a Christmas cover and it's like too heavy and sludgy, and it's just like not really Christmassy or fun at all. It loses the melody. And I think our feeling was like, we never want to lose the melody. Like, we didn't want to do anything that was so grotesque or violent that it just starts to feel really mean-spirited,
like,
or terrible.
Like the Silent Night, Deadly Night remake.
I was going to say.
That's the exact example.
I was going to say, you're not going to go full Mariah Carey Christmas, but you want to do more Tales from the Crypt Keeper Christmas kind of thing.
Yeah. Fun. And there's still, you know, there's, we were making sure up front as we were putting it together that, like, you know, it wasn't going to be completely it doesn't feel like a kid's show.
Right.
You know, it lives somewhere between Tales from the Crypt and something a little bit less harsh. But that said, there are a couple episodes that get really dark. There's a couple moments throughout that were really moments that were like, oh my God, I can't believe we're getting away with this. But yeah, and then there's some episodes that are really funny, and there's some episodes that kind of straddle the line. And we really tried to make sure, without giving away anything, we really tried to make sure that we incorporated that each episode felt like it was tackling a different subgenre of horror.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So we were really trying to make sure that we were marrying. We kind of had unspoken rules of like no Killer Santa, no Krampus, you know, stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, stuff that yeah. we hadn't. The stuff that feels like it's been done really well yeah. already, and there's no reason necessarily to do it again. And that led us down some super fun, weird roads, and we were able to
you
tackle
get a lot out of Christmas horror. We even had a couple episodes. Well, we have one lost episode that we didn't get to do because of like location yeah. issues, and we had a couple concepts that we didn't write. So
yeah, we have half of season two already.
Season two, guys. Season two.
I noticed so, yeah. you didn't exclude Killer Snowman. Which is an interesting omission. I'm just curious. Confirm, deny, what's going on?
Snow's really up? Expensive.
As you can see from it's a Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 3. Brian Yuzna's all shot
Frost.
In LA yeah. and nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
Can so. I say those three words? Because I heard that that's. is that too
No, that's giving a little too much away.
Because right, we'll that made me laugh out loud when yes. one of your writers told me that that's what one of the episodes
Rob
was.
Is slipping notes.
Rob!
Well, because I don't
Rob,
know.
Rob okay. is sliding.
We just got one of those inside. Oh, you guys are inside.
You guys are too inside.
Damn you.
But you'll be able
one
to
of those
find...
words was Santa. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, very cool, guys. So December 12th is when it airs.
Mm-hmm. And then, the pilot comes out the 12th. If you sign up for the free trial of YouTube Red, you can immediately watch episode 2
right.
that day.
Right.
And
so
then
the pilot will be in front of the paywall so you can see how awesome it is and then sign up. And I think YouTube offers a free month, first month free trial if you have not used the service yet.
Yeah.
So.
And it's pretty easy. My grandparents signed up for it. So it's pretty easy to sign up for.
Chris's grandparents endorse it.
And then they'll release one a day up until Christmas Eve, I think,
yeah.
or however
that because it was strategically placed, so it was like 12 days.
Yeah, so it's a countdown to Christmas.
Right.
And each of the episode titles, if you slot it into the 12 Days of Christmas song, you can sing it with new words.
That's amazing. So, very cool. So, all right. Well, thanks for coming on, guys.
Thanks for having us.
12.
Thank you, guys.
So cool. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, same. And happy holidays.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Happy holidays to you. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, guys. So, yes. What have we seen this week?
Back to the business.
A lot to talk about. Yeah.
No, Elric is trying to undress, and that's not.
Elric's
he's trying to get comfortable. That's all.
Maybe I'll run and get a drink while you guys talk.
yeah, we're that boring. I know.
Guys, I gotta tell you, I got a doozy. I got a doozy.
Doozy.
For you.
Yeah. Bring out the doozy. Let's,
do you want?
Let's
do you want
right
the doozy? Because I've been
let's
teasing
start there,
it. I've been teasing.
Yeah.
So there was a film that hit the festival circuit. It was at AFI that I failed to mention. It's called The Untamed.
Hmm.
So it is a.
I just got a press release on this.
Did you really?
I think it may have been a press release. I may have just gotten an email that somebody asked me if I'd seen it.
It's a Mexican horror film by director Amat Escalante, and it's predominantly a drama about four people whose lives all collide, and they kind of have like relationship issues. The wife. The mother of two has a husband. The husband is sleeping with a male nurse. The male nurse is treating this young woman who has sexual issues in a bad relationship with something she keeps revisiting in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere. Hmm. And what resides in this cabin is something that fell to Earth.
It's a meteorite, right?
It's a meteorite.
Okay, yeah.
And
I've heard about this one.
And this thing, this creature, is being cared for by an older couple, one of them being a scientist. And basically he's studying it, but the creature is a representation of euphoric pure love. What it emits is love. What it emits, like it just releases these pheromones. So animals are drawn to it. People are drawn to it. But there's a lot of tentacle sex. Yeah. And it is nice. Absolutely
Elric's awake.
Insane.
Yeah.
Now, Elric is looking at me with the intensity of someone who loves me.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this movie, it's a really finely defined character piece wrapped in just a weird creature bubble. Like, it's a weird movie. And it literally begins with a girl pleasuring herself until you realize, oh, there's a tentacle that's attached to her. Okay, got it. And then it just kind of goes into the you know, relationship drama for a good, you know, half hour. But I don't want to give too much more away because I feel like, you know, I don't know why the buzz out of the festival circuit hasn't been this strong, but I was absolutely enamored by the movie. It is weird. It has a voice. It's very, very character driven. It's very unsettling.
When does it come out?
I don't think it has a distributor yet because they're just it's been on a couple festivals like in South America and Mexico. It played at AFI. It played at Venice Film Festival.
Which one did you catch it? I missed the start when you were saying
AFI.
I didn't see it on the lineup.
Yeah. I think it was at AFI.
Mexico has really been coming out with some extreme horror stuff lately. Like we had. I can't remember the name of it. The two kids who get lost in the...
Here Comes the Devil.
Here Comes the Devil. Yeah. And then this year I saw We Are the Flesh, which might be the most disturbing film I saw
and,
this year.
You know, the We Are the Flesh, I started kind of getting those vibes, but this is a very controlled... where that movie is a fever dream, this is like very controlled. There's a narrative, there are character arcs, there's all sorts of stuff.
We Are the Dream goes everywhere you think it won't. Like you spend the whole movie going, oh, it's not going to, oh, it just did that. Like
it's really intense. Yeah. It's a really, really solid film. And dude, Elric, this is your jam. This is your jam.
You had me at tentacle sex. You always will have me at tentacle sex.
Really, really solid film. So I literally caught on to it today. It's nuts.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Nice. Rob G. I leave the tentacles to you.
Oh boy, thank you. I'm gonna pair two up together. One because they're both short for me. But I finally saw The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which you guys have spoken so highly of. And I'm gonna keep it short because we're all doing our best of the year episode, and at least half of you are going to pick it.
Yeah,
it will probably be on my top 10 of the year as well. I really thought it was excellent. I don't know why I didn't realize this, but I'll watch Brian Cox read the phone book pretty much because he's such a fantastic actor. And the thing about this is it's best – I mean – the title is all you need to know. I'd rather not give anything else away.
Yeah, don't even watch trailers, man.
No trailers, no nothing. Just watch it blindly.
Were you solo watching it?
Yeah, I watched it by myself. But even the first half or so, because obviously it revolves around an autopsy. And it's kind of weird because I had just gone – the day before I watched it, I had a friend visiting from out of town that insisted we go to the Museum of Death here in Los Angeles.
Oh, that place, it's bleak. It's like you think it's going to be cool. It's pretty bleak.
No, but I'll tell you what. I went once 5 years ago, and it was bleak, and I didn't think I'd ever go again. But this friend really was insistent about it. I was like, all right, fine. So the Museum of Death is a museum out here that specializes in things like, you know, like true crime and autopsy.
Casey paintings, Black Dahlia photos.
Yeah, you see some pretty horrific shit going through that. It takes you a good hour or two to do it. But
there's a method to the madness and its layout. You literally begin in the funeral parlor. You begin at the end, and then it kind of takes you through theme things, celebrity deaths, cult deaths.
It's almost every aspect of death examined. Yeah. And I mean, it was pretty funny. When I went 5 years ago, on my way out, like the owner's like, have a nice life.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, they say things like that that kind of creep you out. But this is a fun trip to the Museum of Death for two reasons. Because first of all, the person I was with was obsessed with autopsy. So we spent a long time in the autopsy room watching autopsy videos. So then when I got to this movie.
Who is this friend?
I know, Rob. I want detail. Rob's autopsy friend.
I hope it's a hot girl.
It's so ambiguous.
So when I watched the movie, I was actually kind of really riveted by the autopsy process because you never really see that in a movie. And what I mean by that is how these guys figure out or speculate cause of death. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why. Like, you'd think, like, oh, cutting up a body, that's just gore or whatever.
Right.
I was really into, like, no, that can't be possible because of these marks and this and that. So I was just in it on a technical level, and then when it takes its turn, I was like, all right, now I dig this a lot. The punchline of that story is that as I was walking out, the gentleman that was talking to us was a guy named Mike that works at the Museum of Death, and he said, I'm a huge Shockwaves.
What?
Yeah.
So shout out to Mike. Thank you so much for being so kind to me and my guest.
That's very cool.
That is awesome.
So that's
that. And Mike, give us a call. Let us know who this guest was.
Yeah, we need details.
And if you are in Los Angeles, definitely check out the Museum of Death.
It's a
sobering experience.
Yeah.
And depends on, you know, what mood you're in coming out. I've seen some weird shit happen there.
I also like inside of it.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you guys offline. Okay. But like okay. I did an article for Rue Morgue about it where I took a tour, but there was something happening in the corner of a room and I was just like,
is it sexual?
I'll just say there was a couple making out heavily.
It was while tentacle I was sex, in wasn't
the,
it?
Tentacle sex.
It was tentacle sex.
I was in the theater. Yeah. You know, the theater of death where they're playing just death videos. Ooh. And I was watching basically a man who had been cut in half by a subway car, but the subway car's metal wheel had severed only so much, so he was still alive.
Ooh.
So there were police officers literally talking to this guy into his death. They were just like, time to let go, dude. And then I hear, you know, someone sloppy making out, and I turn around, and it's just a couple just like making straight
horrific.
Out. And
weird.
I was like, I gotta go. I'm gonna move into the cannibal section of this museum.
I feel like that's what all our parents think horror fans are like.
Yeah.
But we know that they're not like that, but then these people give them a bad name. You know?
Yeah. To be honest, as I walked in, because you know, where the entrance is you walk in, but that's also where the exit is. Yeah. So as we walked in, there was like a whole family coming out, and I felt so terrible because they had like little kids. They were like maybe 12, and I was like, "That's really
it's too much. There's too much. It's too much. There's too many much. Because there's a lot of authentic photos.
Black Dahlia photos are so surreal.
Well, no. Yeah. I'm just talking about not even the Black Dahlia. The Black Dahlia photos and that kind of like the OJ Simpson
up
stuff
on the light.
They've been like thrust into the pop culture spotlight. Yeah. We've seen them online, but then like those photos,
everything.
Of people you don't even know, like real people. Like you just see like, oh, here's a lawnmower death, and it's like, oh, I'm never mowing a lawn in my life.
Yeah.
It's grisly.
But I do have to also recommend the Death Tour.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly fun and uplifting. Yes. It's a great tour. It's my favorite one in
Los
Angeles.
The first day material, Becca.
It actually is. The Dearly Departed Tour. It's fantastic. I did it a couple years ago before Dave's parents moved out here. They were coming into town and we needed something to do with them. And his mom's really into like ghost stories. So we were like, we'll go on this maybe. And I was covering it for Fango, so I got a free ticket anyway. And so we did that and it was awesome. It's a lot of like not the gossipy type stuff that you get on the other Hollywood tours. Like you don't go see the Kardashians' house, but you see Bela Lugosi's last
house.
What's
the point then?
quick aside, I looked up the AFI description for The Untamed and they call it, Elric, a spiritual sequel to The Possession.
Possession?
Oh, sorry, Possession.
Oh, there we go. Spiritual.
So sequel to the Jewish horror film. Look out for it.
Typic box.
Box is back, man.
Becca, what'd you see?
So I watched Don't Go to Sleep, and we have talked about it. It has come up twice on our show so far. It came up once on Killer POV where Brian Collins was talking about like one of his favorite movies from his childhood, and then it came up on Shockwaves a couple weeks ago. I think it was Lee Whannell was talking about
the
how
TV
it was
movie.
Like,
yeah, that's right.
1982 made for TV movie. It stars Valerie Harper because it's a made for TV movie, and I think it was like a requirement that you had to put her in there in the 80s. It's got Dennis Weaver in it, and it's also got the kid from Poltergeist. The son from Poltergeist plays the son in this, and for those of you guys who are Annie fans, the lead is Duffy from Annie. If you were like a girl during the 80s, you know exactly who that is. And then the grandma in it is played by Mrs. Castavetes from Rosemary's Baby. So you like watch it and everybody's really recognizable.
Ruth Gordon.
It's scary. It's weird. It's definitely a made-for-TV movie where you can tell that they're not trying to like really push the envelope that far, but it's got some really terrifying scenes in it. The setup is that this family, one of the daughters has died, so they now have a daughter and a son still alive, and they move to a brand new house, and grandma moves in with them. And grandma keeps putting up pictures of the dead daughter because she doesn't want to forget her. And mom's like, no, other daughter has psychological issues. You can't put up these pictures. Well, as soon as the pictures go up, the other daughter, the one that's still alive, starts seeing the dead daughter around the house. Mm-hmm. But the dead daughter isn't just like, hey, what up, sis? Let's play Lego. She's like, you need to kill the rest of the family so we can be together. And then other family members start dying. And I'll leave it there. But it's like got some genuinely terrifying moments to it. And it's got – and even Jeff Nelson from Scream Factory immediately was like, wait till you get to the pizza cutter scene. The most terrifying scene with a pizza cutter in history.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Salt.
So
you had me a pizza cutter.
Like one of those like a little rotate, like circular pizza cutters?
Like seriously, like you never think of that as like a terrifying tool, but it's a terrifying pizza cutter scene.
Wow.
And this one's really hard to find. It did a really limited VHS release like back in the late 80s and then nothing. I got a copy from a friend of a friend of a friend.
One of those. I get it.
Yeah. I've also been told that there's copies of it online, but so it's a tough one to hunt down, but if you can find it, I recommend it. It was a good watch.
Nice.
All right. Ulrich. Speaking of Becca, you're fucking crazy.
What?
I know this.
Here it comes.
Because he texted
Eyes of My Mother is a fucking masterpiece. It might be 20 minutes short of being like a real master, but for a first film, the shooting style is like basically perfect. Every frame's almost a fucking perfect painting. There's only about two handheld shots in the whole movie.
I'm not saying that it's not pretty.
I knew I wasn't.
But I thought you said it was rough.
I'm saying it's not that it's not beautiful. It is a beautiful, like if you freeze frame the scenes, they are beautiful.
But you said
there is something about it that was pulling me out. Like I made me so aware that it was a film.
Yeah, I mean it's very controlled. No, I know I can do it. But I'm just saying, it's very rare for people to actually nail American Gothic, the actual feeling of American Gothic. That's probably one of the first ones in years, because the guys who made like Jugface and all those movies, they're close, but it's they're like so that. Obvious.
Yeah.
This thing's like feels so like kind of heartfelt. It's simple. You feel the pacing of the movie is really strange because it's a very elliptical. So you get one chapter and you get like 15 minutes and then it moves a couple years forward and big things happen. And the movie's 77 minutes. I mean, it is short. It is why I admitted a couple people, I was like, I think it definitely could have had 15, 20 minutes more, which I don't usually feel in the film. But what I loved about it was just how specific the choices were. I felt for a debut, this is my film. Like the choices being made in this movie were very bold. I mean, there's an Eye of God shot where you're like, how the fuck did you do that?
Oh, I know.
It's not a drone because it's not moving. It just cuts to this shot looking down, looks like from, twice the size a crane could go up. So it just had this really measured approach. I mean, there's little nitpicky things throughout, but I love seeing a film by somebody who goes, hey, I have a voice. This is what I wanted to say. I'm not trying to be like other filmmakers. Yep. This is it.
Yeah.
I think
Take it or leave it. You know?
The whole time, it's like I didn't really get engaged with it. I never lost myself in it. I was very aware that it was a film. And it's not even, I think that this happened a couple of times in it, but it's like when he would leave the camera stagnant for a long stretch of time and the characters would move in and out of the scene. It's a very bold choice, but when it happened for a long stretch of time, it just made me more aware that I was watching a film. And so I couldn't connect with it.
I wish I'd been thinking about you saying that when I watched, because that was definitely not saying across my mind. But I don't want to cinema police it, but I do think... But I do want to say there are some movies that like that one definitely doesn't suit a computer screen.
I
watched it on the biggest TV I could. I wish I'd seen in theaters even, because it's all about composition and size, kind of like A Girl Who Walks Home Alone would be best TV.
Which we
computer.
Saw on the big screen too.
But it's not that long. But I just was really taken by it, and I thought it was especially also because it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's such a shortish film.
But it also moves slow. So I think I didn't mind the pacing, and I think if it had 20 more minutes, I would have minded.
But it's fucked up. I mean, it's got some things in that where
intense.
It's like a female Dahmer. It's almost like the birth of a female Dahmer story.
Because
people forget about Dahmer. He is actually, he's a figure. That's why he's kind of a tragic figure. He's doing things out from his perspective out of love, not sadistic cruelty, even though objectively that's what you're seeing. Right. And I feel like this is a character trying to fill her lonely void by doing these awful things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, absolutely.
And I thought it was fascinating.
You never look at her as an evil character throughout.
Not once, really.
She's always your protagonist whole time.
There's a couple moments where you are very scared about what she's about to do, a couple of very key moments without spoilers towards the end where you're like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't go where it's going.
Right.
But it's just a really interesting movie. I really think people try to check that one out before your best of list. I think it's a nice little gem that kind of just squeaked out at the end of the...
And it just came out on VOD.
VOD.
That's where I saw it.
I watched it last week.
And his name's Nicholas Pinsky, and it's a couple of people asked us, will you have him on? I almost did at one point, but it was he's a New York-based person.
Yeah.
And I'm sure when they're out.
Next time he's out, I'm sure he will be.
But a very cool debut. And there's another one I wanted to say pair it with just because it was another debut. And no one's talking about this film, and I think it's because it's not called a horror film. It's called The Fitz. And it was, I was listening to this podcast,
FITS.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast called Film Spotting, and they highlight the best independent film of the year. They're looking at all the films, and two out of three of them are saying, this is it. And I hadn't even heard of this thing. And they said it's free on Amazon Prime. I went home and watched it. And they said it's about, I wasn't sold instantly. They're a young African-American girl who's about 9 or 10, boxes with her brothers in a community center. Mm-hmm. And then eventually she starts noticing that the girls across the hall are all doing dance. And it's kind of that in-your-face kind of dance where you're challenging the other people to dance back. It's pretty intense.
Yeah. Crumping.
It wasn't quite crumping, but it's like got that kind of attitude. And she starts noticing it, but it's like this weird adolescent movie. And I'm just listening to this review going, oh, that sounds cool. And then they... But it's kind of a horror film in my eyes. Ears start perking
up. It's
like
a little bit about hysteria.
Well, yeah, but it's about hysteria. So what starts happening, she starts joining the dance troupe, and then a couple minutes. It's a very, again, it's a short measured film, probably 80 minutes. One girl from this group starts to have this weird, almost epileptic fit without the epilepsy, where they start shaking, and it's actually kind of disturbing and scary. And then one by one, every couple days, one of the other girls is getting this thing. There's no explanation, no medical, but best of all, as this girl walks around kind of wondering when she will get it, because she isn't getting it and is wondering why she's different. And at one point, there's even something almost supernatural in terms of the fits. But what's happening is there is a full-on horror soundtrack, the whole movie. So this is scored like literally like an It Follows, and it creates a totally different movie if it didn't have that. If it didn't, you'd be like, oh, it's realistic. It's really interesting. But when it adds this layer of the soundtrack, I literally tweeted straight away, like, I'm not even kidding. That's the person I would choose to do an It Follows sequel. Like, without hesitating, because it's unique, it's different, it's grounded in realism, but it actually felt like It Follows in quite a few sequences, because it's all set at this community center. You never see parents, you never see political people. There's some rumors that maybe something in the water did it. So it's I think it's based in Cincinnati. But this thing, you know, a lot of the people who listen to this, they know my taste by now. This might not be for you. So, you know, look it up, maybe watch the trailer. But if you're interested in taking a risk on saying and go, what is this movie? I looked up the director. Her name is Anna Rose Helmer.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, it's very hypnotic. She's worked on dance movies before, because she produced one called Dance 422.
I did notice that, when I looked her up. But there's no clear explanation, but it's one of those films you feel, and it tells you a lot. It's just so interesting, the aesthetics of a horror film. And I think we're in a period now where some horror films are just the aesthetic and some are the story elements, right?
Right.
This is one of those movies that it just shows that if you add a soundtrack, which is a very purposeful thing, it's not accidental that you add something as menacing as this to the movie. So I think it's interesting. It won't be forever. But just talking on the heels of Eyes of My Mother, I think they're both very interesting in that way.
It's been in my queue. Someone had flagged that one as a hidden horror movie to me, and I was just like, okay, I'll check that out. That and Creesha?
Yeah, Creesha people have talked about as it. But for you, the reason I would suggest is less the movie itself, more as like, that could be somebody who,
the
horror script,
absolutely.
Could really knock it out of the park. And I had a fun watching it. I thought it was really interesting.
iTunes has it under drama.
Yeah, well, that's...
It definitely wouldn't be in a horror category, but then you would listen. Anyone who watches horror films would go, yeah, well, you can't deny these sequences being the feeling of dread, because you don't explain what these fits are. It has to be considered like a supernatural film. Yeah. I love those movies that you don't know where they exist in the spectrum. So there's two of the ones I've seen. Yeah. I've seen a couple of things, but
There was a couple of things. I revisited Krampus over the weekend while I was decorating the house. Krampus.
I'm looking forward to revisiting
it.
It
holds up really well, and I think my experience watching it at home was a lot better than watching it at the theater. And I just think it's just because I don't know, there was a finer appreciation for what it was trying to be, which was like a great Amblin creature movie, Once I kind of cut through the pacing of it, which I kind of had issues with at first, but I no longer have a problem with. But there was one that I want to mention. Again, I'm going for two films this episode that are on the way, but I want to flag them now for you guys. It played at East Coast Film Festival. Heather Buckley immediately hit me up, and she was like, you need to talk to the producer. They have this great film. I just saw it at this film festival. She wrote a review for it on Dread Central, and she put me in touch with the filmmakers. It's called 1974, and it is a Mexican horror film about...
Another one.
Yeah. I know, that's been my kick this week. It is a found footage horror film, which I was kind of like, okay. But it's, I believe it was shot in 16mm.
Oh, cool.
But it's very authentic.
Oh, it just perked up his ears.
It's set in 1974. There were some logistical things I had issues with, but It's about a guy who just lives, you know, in this really quaint house. Well, it begins in black and white with a really disturbing news, like reporter doing some investigative journalism, going to this house that has a lot of commotion and authorities surrounding it. He's like walking up going, what happened here? What's going on? He's talking to the neighbors, and they're like, all we heard was an explosion. It sounded like a freight train. Hmm. And he's like, but there's no railroad tracks. You like live out in the sticks. And they're like, that's why we're puzzled as to what happened. It sounded like a sonic boom. Hmm. And so when you're kind of left with that mystery, you're introduced to a couple who live out in the house, and it's very Paranormal Activity-esque. But suddenly the wife is being visited by quote unquote angels. Hmm. And she basically starts painting these kind of black bricks, and she starts making a wall in her house, one upstairs, one downstairs. And he's like, why are you building a wall? Why were you building this doorway? And I'll leave the mystery there. But what works for it is, one, the scares work really, really well. The kind of found footage aesthetic, I could give or take, whatever, you know, like for me, I'll watch a found footage film as long as you have kind of a good approach, as long as you know, you root your characters in something. The characters are kind of cool. The concept is cool. The mythology they start to build is cool. But for me, it was super, super creepy. And it went into a direction I didn't expect. And then I was like, okay, that was a nice surprise. But I don't know what's happening with the film right now, but it's making the film festival route. I think I spoke to the filmmaker actually today, and he said he was I think he was in Japan, I believe. Don't quote me on it, but he was overseas showing the film at another film festival. Hmm. So it'll probably creep up on you guys sometime in the next year, but definitely worth checking out.
And I then love I also that the net of foreign horror is getting to more interesting countries, like making stuff.
Yeah. Mr. G.
I just have one more thing, which will lead to a topic that I want to close this out. So I'd rather you guys go if there's anything else.
I got two more.
I was going to say, have you guys seen The Exorcist director's cut from Screen Factory? Exorcist 3? Yeah,
oh,
sorry.
Yeah. Not yet. I talked about it.
I watched it. I finally watched it over the weekend, and I prefer the theatrical cut.
No, yeah, yeah. I usually do. It's interesting, but nobody had
warned me as to how abrupt.
Oh, I said it on the show.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, I mistake.
The ending alone will piss you off.
Yeah. It did piss me off. It just was like, oh, yeah, okay, great.
Everyone argues about like, oh, but then they just went and added an exorcism to the movie.
Right.
But when you watch that director's cut, you're like, well, yeah. Because the way it ends, you're like, you know what this movie needs?
Well,
an exorcism right here. Because it just ends.
It's a different kind of beast. I mean, like, the ending would have been fine if it had the runway to get to that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if it had a sense of escalation. There's no escalation,
you know,
because it's a very stilted, you know, quid pro quo, Clarice, you know, kind of like back and forth between, you know, Brad Dourif and George C. Scott. But
it's interesting to see if you're a fan of the movie, but the theatrical is the better film.
Yeah.
And it's been taking me a while, but I'm actually working on an article for the site called Theatrical or Director's Cut. Like, which do you prefer? Because it changes from film to film on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. But it's rare that I like director's cuts more weirdly.
Yeah,
I'm kinda, the same way.
Yeah, I tend to like the original.
Because usually
theatrical.
The good director's cuts were ones that aren't called director's cut. They're just the movie.
Usually I always, if I'm given a choice, I'll always go for the theatrical cut just because the director's cut always feels clunkier to me.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right, so shoot off yours so I can...
Yeah.
Well, one I won't go into too much depth, but I have to say I saw it again. The Pit, I watched again.
And there, why?
And I flat out, I'm not even kidding, flat out love the movie now. Like, I liked it a lot the first time I saw it. I think this is one of those, like, okay, who the fuck, where
you're,
the fuck,
you're a lunatic.
Where the fuck did the rumor that Canadian people are boring come from? Because if you watch Canexploitation films, they are the craziest perverts on the face of the fucking earth, man. Canada is getting a bad rap. Like, watch those movies. I find that movie absolutely fascinating. It's a lot of movies in one, but it's actually one of my favorite of these, like, childhood horror movies. Now, I wish I'd seen it as a kid, but I'm going to save it because I'm actually going to be on tomorrow a show called the Splat House podcast, and just talking about this for like 20 minutes. I call in, and all I do is talk about The Pit for 20 minutes because they'd say, what do you want to talk about? I'm like, if you guys are talking about The Pit, I'm in. I've got a lot more theories on The Pit, but you can listen to it there.
Yeah, you bring him to that other show.
I will say, you don't like The Pit? That's insane.
You ruminate on that one.
It's like seven different movies.
Splat, yeah, and they're all fantastic. There's a scene where he pulls out the Polaroids of a nude woman and Teddy his teddy bear looks down and goes, I'm going to look at them a lot. And it's the greatest line in the history of cinema. If you're watching it right now, you know what I'm talking about. I love it. And it's basically, there's a book that apparently is a darker version of it called Teddy.
Yeah.
And it's $150 on eBay. It's one of these adaptations that might be in Stephen Sagarlov's documentary.
So, wait, it's like a novelization.
It was a novelization afterwards that is apparently more like the original script. And then the guy made it funnier when he directed it, but apparently is a lot darker.
Okay.
Wait, the pit's funny?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's hilarious.
I don't remember this as funny. This is way too much on the pit. I remember it as creepy.
The Pit is one of the, I'm not even kidding, I think The Pit is such a fun movie. I think you're crazy if you don't like The Pit.
Oh my gosh.
I also want to recommend, just, I'm not going to talk about it, but you guys, if you haven't seen Hell or High Water, I think that's up there now with The Green Room for my favorite just film of the year. I had not seen it yet. I thought it was a period piece, so I kind of avoided it. It's like, oh, it's a guy's westerns robbing banks. I was like, yeah, I'm waiting to see it. I watched it, and I was like, oh, my God. I watched that in Manchester by seeing all these Oscar movies that went to the theater on Friday. That movie blew them all the fuck away. Jeff Bridges, everyone in this movie is amazing. It's thrilling. It's like, it's just fucking great.
Is it a horror movie?
No, it's a, no, it's like a noir thriller. When did that ever stop us before? speaking of which,
unless I had brought it up, in which case you would all give me shit. So
yeah, well, you deserve it. speaking of non-horror noirs, you should watch The Frontier, a film I helped produce, and it is available today on Netflix. And it has Jocelyn Donahue and AJ Bowen in it, Jim Beaver, all three horror icons, in my opinion. And I think it's a really good movie. Orin Chai did a great job directing it.
Way to bring it back.
Hey, you know, you guys, you know. We've heard that she has a PhD for 17 years.
We literally began pimping a Blumhouse show.
We did. So don't get on my case.
I'm going to throw one more title out because I've been going through my DVDs, kind of shrinking it down. I started this process about a year ago where I suddenly realized that I had 6 bookcases full of DVDs. And I was like, you know what? I need to shrink down just a bit. So I've been kind of going through every couple of weeks and being like, why do I need to own Slivus and things like that? Which is a question you should really ask yourself at some point. Why do I need to own Slivus? So today, or last night, I went through and I was like, I own Rose Red. I don't even really remember Rose Red.
Why do I own Rose Red?
So then I watched Rose Red. Rose Red was the Stephen King miniseries from 2002. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a mix of the Winchester Mystery House if The Haunting took place there.
And that was his intent.
Yeah.
That's it.
Exactly. That was like the pitch line. But yeah, so it's this woman who believed that if she ever stopped building the house, spirits would come get her or something like that. And then a parapsychologist scientist takes psychics there and one kid with autism to see what happens. And of course, they all start having crazy haunting experiences. Really cool first part, but it goes on for like 6 parts too long.
Yeah, it's super dry.
Yeah, it gets really, really dry by the end.
That came out of an era of like really bland Stephen King adaptations or Stephen King TV properties where it was like he did that kind of Kingdom remake.
Yeah.
He did Rose Red. There was the Salem's Lot thing. It was just like, oh.
And it's Rose Red starts really strong. Like the first hour, I was like, why don't I remember this? This is great. Like it's got this cool scene with a carousel and there's a giant doll's house and just like a really cool house setting. And then as soon as the ghosts show up, it just gets really bland. Yeah. But, and they made a second part to it called The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, which
like
I watched too. And that was really bad.
Oh my God.
But we'll save it for a big Stephen King episode one day.
We should.
Rank them all, all those motherfuckers.
Stephen King movies.
That's the Joe Madry one. Because he's read every one of the books.
I know you want to move on. I have one more because I can't get away from it. This one, I saw the premiere of Siren, and I can't be objective about it because they're friends of mine who wrote it. And Greg Bishop. I had a lot of fun because it's a goofy as hell movie.
Some people know, it's the first skit in VHS adapted into a movie.
And it couldn't be more different than VHS. And I won't lie, it took me the first 20 minutes to adjust from that because it's so grounded in the, you know, docudrama found footage film. It's such a different tone. And this is like, it starts out kind of more like, you know, Hostel, I guess, like kind of goofy. It's a bachelor party horror film.
I've heard Chase is fun.
I find Chase really fun, but it also goes so over the top at times with crazy sexual stuff. And it really did win me over. And I was actually, you know, even when they're friends of yours, sometimes I'm surprised because I don't think the tone was pitched in my wheelhouse in terms of the kind of stuff I usually would go to, but I felt like they were just having so much fun with it, and it's made for it. Like, looks like they're making a lot out of a little all the way through, and I think any scene where Chase is on screen with the I Like You creature was so good that it really just, like, I think it's about halfway through. The problem with the screening was the arena cinema out here, it literally broke like three times the projection. They had to like restart. And so it was pretty hard on the filmmakers to have to go through that. And finally, they got it working. But for me, it was like, it felt like Tales from the Dark Side, you know, the Gargoyle kind of storyline. It had that kind of vibe. But, you know, what I'd say is make sure you see it from Redbox or something, because this is going to play in Chiller. And there is so much sexuality and swearing, and this thing's going to get cut to.
No, but it's on Chiller, it's on VOD right now.
But Chiller doesn't edit.
They don't?
No.
Even like sexuality and swear words?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so either, but it is on a like regular sci-fi. VOD as well.
Yeah, so it's regular. So make sure you watch it in this period, but I think you'll have a lot of fun. It's, you know, it's always hard when you know the people involved, but I know that and Beyond the Gates, I felt like, because they're kind of hitting right around the same time, they both have that throwback 80s vibe to them, and yeah, they're both funny and fun, and I had fun with it.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, the last thing I want to talk before that, before you got here, Elric, me and Ryan were talking, Ash vs. Evil Dead, almost wrapping season 2.
Okay, I'm about halfway through, but
episode 9 was my favorite episode so far of the season.
Yeah. Wait, so it's not over yet this season?
One more to go. Okay, okay, one more to go. But the way they've teed up the end of this season is just so much fun. If you're a fan of Army of Darkness, which they finally incorporated into the show in a really fun way, and in particular, as I've said before, Evil Dead 2 is my favorite movie. I know you still have to finish the episode. They do service to Evil Dead 2. If you're a fan of that, that's just so cool and bringing back things that we love about those movies. So, show's fantastic. I think this season was 10 times better than the last one. But lastly, you know, Universal Monster movies are my comfort movies. Mm. So earlier in the week, I threw on The Wolfman, and then I went right into Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, which initially I didn't like that movie as much. Like, Universal sequels are always kind of hit or miss for me. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason I didn't like it is because as a kid, I wanted to see them fight, and they fight for 30 seconds towards the end. But I actually really loved it this time because it's just a Wolfman sequel.
Yeah.
Like, it picks up right where it's the Wolfman. Yeah. So when you watch them back to back in that context, and then it's like, oh, and Frankenstein shows up. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But
and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman leans into one of the Frankenstein sequels. It picks up from there.
Oh, yeah. I think House of Frankenstein somewhere is next.
Because he's all covered in like clay or whatever like that. Because he's been buried or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, one day we'll get a Universal expert on here because I loved the continuity that they would pick up from film to film.
Pre-Marvel, guys.
Pre-Marvel. They already had a quote-unquote shared universe, which, speaking of, so the Mummy trailer debuted. Mm-hmm. Giant, big-budget Universal movie with Tom Cruise and
Russell Crowe.
I was like watching Dr. Jekyll.
What?
Yeah. He's Dr. Jekyll.
Okay, now I'm more interested.
Yeah, so that's cool.
I didn't pick that up from the trailer.
And it's directed by, what's his name, Alex Kurtzman? Is that the guy? Yeah. Who's mostly known as a writer on
Kurtzman,
Star Trek
and
those guys. But he's the director. And here's the reason I wanted to bring up, because I wrote a whole piece on the website this week, and the trailer debuted, and it's not bad. It looks like a giant summer blockbuster Tom Cruise popcorn movie.
Yeah, the effects looked fun.
But it doesn't look like a horror movie or a mummy movie or a Universal Monster movie.
It looks like a Stephen Sommers, like,
but not even, because it's a little more serious than the Stephen Sommers movies, for example. Like, it looks like a legit, like, it looks, you know, people joked, oh, it's like Mummy Impossible, like a Mission Impossible scene. Fine. But then the day after the trailer, they released a featurette, which is kind of like, you know, inside look. And the featurette's cool, and I read an interview with Alex Kurtzman, and it seems like he has a great deal of affinity for the Universal Monsters and understands why they work. And this featurette could not hammer the point. Like, I literally quoted it in my article. Tom Cruise said he was utterly terrified by the Mummy when he was growing up. This movie is going to be terrifying. What she does is horrifying. The audience is going to be terrified from start. And I'm like, nothing in that first trailer.
No.
Because that wasn't a trailer.
It looks like an action film.
It's a teaser.
But that's what I'm saying is, I understand the movie's 7 months away, and that's the first tease, and you got to get the Tom Cruise. But that's the thing is, I hope that they're going to make going to be more of a monster movie
and
as it goes along.
Yeah, and if you reach back to John Spates, who's the screenwriter on this, if you reach back to a little bit further, he even quotes it as going, I'm trying to bring more horrifying elements to the Mummy movies.
Okay.
Because that's where Stephen Sommers is kind of like
– there's another part to this that's what I think you bring up is have you – what's the biggest – film you've seen that's actually scary and a big scale? It's hard. Yeah. All of our favorite horror films tend to be intimate in a room, right?
1999's The Haunting.
Get out of here.
But it is interesting. But, like, you look at scale. Like, World War Z isn't scary, but then 28 Days Later is scary.
Yeah,
scale is, like,
even
more focused. You
Crimson
know?
Ghost. Or, sorry, Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak,
Crimson Ghost, no. But Crimson Peak, you know, I was really hoping that that would be scary, and then you watch it, and it's just kind of like, it looks pretty.
And that has a big scale budget. But I mean, like, big scale isn't like, you know, we're showing big things in the world, and everything's blowing up. And it's like, I can't think of a film that's ever really been haunting or scary with that.
I genuinely hope
scenario,
it's
you know?
These, mm-hmm. you know, because they have the plan. Obviously, mm-hmm. you know, Russell Crowe's going to be Dr. Jekyll, and they're setting that up. But there is one throwaway quote that a lot of people ran with, and I think it's out of context and it doesn't really mean anything, but Alex Kurtzman said, yes, the original monster movies are totally in continuity with what we're doing. Not Dracula Untold, the original one. So that Dracula, that Frankenstein, that all happened. And I'm like,
oh, I see.
So it's just all in the same universe.
They asked him, and the reason I say I don't trust the quote is because he reluctantly answered it. Yeah. But if that's the case, because then I saw a speculative article saying, well, if that's the case, then the version of the Wolfman we see or Frankenstein monster could actually be the original ones. And the thing is, Universal, for example, when they do Frankenstein, Universal owns the rights to the block-headed,
and
you know.
The screws on
so
there.
So he could
the
look actually like, if they keep going in that direction, I'm all for it. And I said, you know what? If we have to sit through six giant summer blockbuster versions of monster movies to get to Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein with Key and Peele versus the monsters,
yeah, like
then I'm
that.
All for it.
Like
that. That's great. It's worth it. Yeah. So I don't know. That those are my thoughts. What did you guys think of the trailer?
I mean, I am admittedly a Tom Cruise fan, even though I grew up in a household with a mother who absolutely hated Tom Cruise because her and Nicole Kidman split.
Oh yeah,
him and Nicole Kidman. No, I think Tom Cruise is like one of the hardest working guys in showbiz. Yeah. Everything he puts creative effort into, he does 100%, even if it doesn't necessarily work. He always works with a specific writer who comes on board and kind of retools the projects a little bit.
I think he's one of the last true movie stars because he sells tickets despite the fact that the stuff in his personality that you learn about Scientology is a turnoff, and then you go to the movies and you forget all that.
It's true, because I've been watching the Scientology documentary that they're doing on A&E right now, and the more I find out about him, the more I'm like, man, that's creepy. I'm still going to go see the movie.
But you forget it once the screen comes out.
But,
you really do.
But putting aside the Scientology bullshit, you know, it's like when I watched Edge of Tomorrow, I'm like,
that was a great movie.
It's Tom Cruise playing a colonel, blah, blah, blah. He's going to be the tough guy. Oh, no, he's a fucking coward in this movie. Like, the first 30 minutes, he wants to run away from war.
That's
now
a great
I'm really
movie.
Interested
first
in
Jack Reacher film kicked ass.
Yeah.
Like, last Mission Impossible film kicked ass. He was amazing in that.
It's one
so
of
he's
those
a weird star.
I really want to not like him, but every single time he does a movie, a lot of times I'm like, oh, I would never go see a movie because he's in it, but I'll start watching it, and then I'm like, oh, this is
besides
really good.
Besides, I actually think Ryan hit on the head. I think it's how hard he works. I think it shows his like passion is just like a passionate director would have for the film. I think he just has never quit. He's just put everything out there, you know?
Right, and I think right now The Rock is kind of to transcend that.
Yeah.
You know, The Rock is an amazing showman, and he's an amazing, like, I don't know if he's an amazing actor.
I don't know if he has the
acting
chops that Tom Cruise has. But,
I don't know.
But
I've heard Moana's really good.
Yeah, but in terms of The Mummy, I'm intrigued, you know? I like the female mummy, and that's the actress, I forget her
from
name.
From King's
Kingsman. Sophia
Wintella.
And,
Kingsman, yeah, she's great.
But I mean, like, you know, in terms of the footage, I loved, you know, seeing these kind of soldiers sitting there looking at this thing in the middle of the planet and going, what are we doing? Like, I want to know how they found it. Where did it come from? How did this get unleashed? The fact that Tom Cruise, quote unquote, apparently dies and then comes back.
Oh, yeah, because the opening is,
he dies in a plane crash, and then he's like waking up in the morgue. It's like, okay, I'm intrigued. I'm really curious to see where they go with it.
And I mean, even though that we were watching, the plane sequence was definitely more action-oriented, it was kick-ass.
Yeah,
so I kind of want to see more of that, too.
Yeah,
I'm definitely curious.
We'll
it was Russell that turned me off, not because I don't like him, but because I was like, what? How big is this? But now that you tell me who he is,
Dr.
it's like,
Jekyll.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
and after Nice Guys, oh my God.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Love
it was
that
so
one,
much fun.
So, yeah, so that's that. We will be back on Monday with an interview with Jackson Stewart, who is the director of Beyond the Gates, which is out today. Select theaters, VOD, digital platforms. And he co-wrote one of the episodes of 12 Deadly Days as well, which I didn't know until the top of the show.
And he's also a guy, and part of what we'll probably talk about is a lot of badass movies that we all love, because that's one thing about Jackson. He loves movies on the level that I think we all love movies, and I think it'll be fun to talk about.
Yep, so tune in Monday, and we'll have that for you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.